What is up, everybody? Welcome to episode 40 of the Go With Elmo podcast. We hope you're digging it. We're having a great time doing it. So for this episode, we're doing the first Go With Elmo encore, which is us reposting an episode from the early days of the Go With Elmo pod. And today's is our interview with Mark Giuliana. So this is back to episode 5 of Go With Elmo. And back in those days, we were doing it on the Jam Card channels because we weren't sure if this is going to be like an all the time thing. But now we have it on the Go With Elmo channels. So we wanted to post it here so we can be back on the Go With Elmo channels. And also, it's an amazing interview with Mark. Mark Giuliana is one of my favorite drummers in the world. You may know him currently from all of his work with St. Vincent. Before that, from his work with David Bowie. He played on David's final album, Black Star, which is an incredible album. And he's just one of the greatest drummers, solo artists ever, beat music. Just watching him play solo, I love Mark. He's an amazing human too. And I really, really loved this interview. We talk about his style, how he developed his sound, how he got the gig with both David Bowie and St. Vincent, and a lot of really great stories. So if you're watching this on YouTube, please subscribe to the Go With Elmo channel. That helps us a lot. Leave comments. Tell us what you think. If you're listening on Spotify or Apple Pod, please follow us. Please leave a review. That would be amazing. We're trying to grow the channel, putting in a lot of love into this, and we got some great interviews coming up. But for our first Go Encore, here it is, our interview with Mark Giuliana.
Go!
So, dude, I'm such a fan of your drumming. I've been watching you for years. I was really excited. Like when I discovered you, I immediately like loved your sound. And you have such a unique style and ideas, and your phrasing and everything is so unique to you, which is like the hardest thing to do on an instrument, especially with drums. How did you create that?
Well, thank you. That's very kind. Means a lot coming from you. I think, part of it is I never really decided to create something. I think a lot of things have happened where just kind of head down, just keep going kind of thing. And then maybe as time passes, if you look back, you're like, oh, okay, I can see why someone may say something kind like that. But to me, it was never this intentional pursuit. I think there are two, if I could like, you know, distill it into two main things. One of them would be just allowing all of my influences to coexist in a natural way. I think when I was younger, I started playing drums in 1995. So that was, you turn on MTV and it's Matt Cameron with Soundgarden, Dave Grohl, Nirvana, Chad Smith, Chili Peppers, it's all that stuff. So that's what I was playing when I first started. Mm. And then through my first drum teacher, Joe Bergamini, who I think you know. Mm-hmm. Have you met Joe?
I have not met him, know of him, yeah.
We kind of touched many different styles and kind of built a foundation. And that's when I discovered jazz, and that kind of kicked open this other door of like, oh, this is cool. I got to check this out. And that happened, you know, maybe with electronic music a couple years later, or with this, or, you know, more folkloric musics. And, but like when I got to jazz school, I've thought like, I can't let anyone know I like Nirvana, you know, they'll make fun of me, and vice versa. Like, you know, oh, I'm playing this rock gig. I can't, you know, I have to like dress differently than I would for my jazz gig, or all these rules that I felt like a peer pressure to kind of abide by. And then over time, it was with just developing a little more confidence of like, no, all this stuff can live together if it's all at the service of the music, you know? So I think if you can let Dave Grohl vocabulary be influenced by Tony Williams vocabulary, or go into a blender with Elvin Jones and Matt Cameron and some West African djembe music or something, that stuff, you'll kind of come out the other side with none of the above. It'll kind of, because you mentioned how did I create that? I think it's, to me, it's less about the creating and more about like taking pre-existing things and just you know, putting them in that blender. And
yeah,
I guess you could argue that the result is something new, but to me, it's the combination of maybe, you know, counterintuitive elements right. coming together.
Yeah, you know? The result is definitely something new. And I didn't mean that you by no means sound like, to me, I don't hear all those different things. I hear you. And I think that that is like, and it's not, yeah, it doesn't sound intentional. It's not like, mm-hmm. oh, you're trying to make this statement and playing this way. It doesn't sound like that at all. It just sounds like you are in a space of your own that you created and you exist in. And I've seen you play so many times. I mean, and now seeing you play with St. Vincent, I got to say you did a great job hiding that you were a rock drummer because I had no idea.
That's funny.
And when you got the St. Vincent gig, it was like, what? Mark on St. Vincent? And then I saw you do it and I was like, Mark on St. Vincent. Right. Oh, this is great. But because I had seen you play, you know, jazz, electronica, everything like your solo stuff and, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. And so many times, but every time you sound different and you're clearly evolving, but you're evolving within that space that you created. So it still sounds stylistically like you, but there's like growth and new phrasing and new ideas in it.
Mm.
So I think to me, that's what I admire so much about you is that you created like an ecosystem or an atmosphere that is like your sound that you can swim through.
Cool. Can I use that for my website?
For like sure. Put the quote.
Really nice.
You got the sound bite now.
Yeah, exactly. But I will say if there's one other thing that I think is kind of underrated or undervalued is like the idea of like sometimes I think more and more at this time in drumming, we're hearing more and more people, you know, with social media and people being able to share things. It's like the first time we're ever hearing people play drums by themselves mm-hmm. in music, you know, relatively. And we're hearing so many different people and it's more than ever tempting to be pulled by, because there's so much amazing stuff
yeah.
that it's very natural to feel magnetized towards that stuff. And then maybe there's this peer pressure. I think maybe I need to do that or I need to, and I think there's a lot of power in learning how to resist those temptations. And sometimes every now and then I think I'm hypersensitive to trends in drumming. And you know, I think something can become trendy has a negative connotation, but with the test of time will, you know, at a certain point there wasn't a hi-hat in the drum set, right? So maybe when people started using a hi-hat, that felt trendy and be like, no, you shouldn't use a hi-hat. Well, actually, the hi-hat has stood the test of time. That's a highly functional element of the kit,
very
you know?
True.
And I think more and more, there are these kind of, you know, potential trends that we don't know what'll stand the test of time. But sometimes for me, I try to be really aware of like, oh man, this guy has this. He got to that first. I'm not allowed to use it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
something like that where it's an exaggeration, but it's been helpful to try to resist these temptations, whether in a setup or things like that, or even vocabulary
yeah.
that might, I don't know, take me off this other path.
Yeah.
You know, so when I was younger, I didn't have any of my own ideas. So I was relying on everyone else's ideas to build a vocabulary.
For sure.
But now I feel like there is this power in trying to resist all this temptation because then we're just filling ourselves up with other people's ideas. And there is a, you know, I do believe there is a finite amount of space for one's ideas, you know, because we just can't do everything. So at some point there's a limit.
Yes.
So if we fill ourselves up with other people's ideas, it's a disservice to ourselves to truly like look in the mirror and try to figure out who we are.
I love that. So you just finished a year and a half tour with St. Vincent. I think a lot of people were probably surprised because they didn't know that you play rock.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously surprising people is great. And it also just shows how versatile you are and everything. But how did, How did that gig come across? Like, how'd you get the St. Vincent gig?
So Justin Meldal Johnson, the bass player in the band, was the MD, yep. is the MD. And
one of the greatest MDs in the game.
I mean, and bass player. I mean, he's scary.
Yes.
Scary. I mean, music just is, from my, it's just so easy for him. Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, it's just,
I mean, I remember him with Nine Inch Nails with Beck, and then him as a producer,
exactly,
getting in the studio and crushing that game as well.
Exactly. So we had been in touch a little bit, and you know, got coffee a couple times after I had moved, and it was always, you know, our musical lives on paper don't totally overlap, but there was this idea of like, oh, it'd be fun to try to do something.
Yeah.
So he invited me on, and the first thing we did was SNL. This is last April.
I remember that.
So yeah, it was just these two songs we rehearsed, you know, and that was great. And then that led, it was still kind of the height of COVID, so nobody was on the road yet.
Yep.
And then we did some more promo stuff in LA, and then as live touring started to happen, we went out for a bunch, and it was incredible. I've difficult to really capture how much fun it was, and for me the contrast to my usual world made it even sweeter.
Yeah, I mean, congrats, you got to play Madison Square Garden, got to play the Forum, you got to play a ton of festivals, main stage festivals.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing, yeah, these massive audiences. I'm sure the buses are nicer.
Yeah, I mean...
Catering.
Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah. I had never really... I had been on a bus, you know, a couple times for a week or so, but here and there, but I'd never done true bus touring. Yeah. You know, in the jazz world, just fly everywhere, get on the plane with my cymbal bag, small suitcase, and just fly, you know? So it was really... it took me 40 years to have my first drum tech. You know,
wow.
Which I was even resistant. I was resistant for that. I was like, do I really need it? I guess it'll.
Oh, all right. Let's talk about that. I think that's really important because so many people wouldn't assume that. Because, yeah, I think people think of you on such a high level. So they're not thinking, even if they see you play at a jazz club and it's a 200 cap room, they're not thinking like, oh, yeah, Mark brought his drums. You know, I think the average person doesn't think about that. But there's like so much love and dedication and passion in that for you to like be at your level, and how many years you've been at your level to just have your first drum tech is pretty incredible.
Totally. And even
and now
that,
you want it.
Well, it's nice. It's nice. But also I like the ritual of the setup and the, you know, it's just like, it's, you know, on some of these festivals, the first time you see your instrument is when you're walking out onto the stage, you know, and it's like,
and it's dialed in for you. And
but even that, like I, you know, I'm saying it was great. And it was, I'm not wishing for the opposite.
Right.
But on the other side of it is like, you set your drums up at 3 p.m. and already the relationship with the instrument on that stage is happening.
Begun. Yeah.
And you're like, oh, this kind of feels like, oh, this room, interesting. So now we're not going to play for another 6 hours, but I'm kind of in that space and I'm aware of maybe what might be small things specific to this room that could just like help engage the, you know, the process of being present and being ready to play.
Yeah.
You know, so, but it was great. It was great. I mean, still a very simple setup. And even that felt like a lot sometimes, you know, and, but yeah, it was funny. There's this guy named Ed Davis who was with us last fall, an incredible drummer. And, he played with Juliet actually.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And super nice guy. And he was looking after Justin and I, cause once the show starts, I don't have any needs from, a tech, you know, but yeah. Justin's got these bass changes and stuff. So it's more about just getting the kit set up and then done. But he's a great drummer, and I learned a lot from him. And there was one of the snare drums I brought had like the factory head on the bottom. The bottom snare head was like the Gretsch factory head.
Yep.
because who changes a bottom snare? Right? It never even crossed my mind to look under there, you know? Yeah. And he's like, dude, you got the factory head on there. I'm like, yeah. Or first I was like, okay. Yeah. And excuse me. And then he was like, there was this one sound check halfway through the tour. I show up to sound check. He's like, I had to change that head. I'm sorry, man. I was like, so it's funny just the way the learn about the level of attention to detail and things like that. For me, it's the last thing on my mind, but it's nice to be looked after.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it was great. But I do, you're right. Like, I'm so grateful for maybe, my first, you know, being 24 and just having a tech thrown at you. I can imagine it being very hard to ever want to put your drums in a car and drive yourself to the gig.
Definitely.
Because to me, that still feels, bringing my own drums feels more normal than not. You know, I think it'll always be that way. That's that new, like you were saying, that burned in New York sensation.
Is that why you always played small kits?
Definitely a part of it.
Yeah.
Definitely. You know, there's those kind of jazz folklore stories of why an 18-inch bass drum, it's like, oh, it could fit in the back of a cab and all these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I definitely, that certainly played a part.
And then all your little 6-inch, 10-inch cymbals.
Exactly. Exactly.
What lightest.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
One ply drums.
That would be nice. Yeah. Yeah.
If they can make them that strong.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool, man. And I know Annie. Annie's great. Introduced to me by Silva and the Silva, the Silva crew.
Yeah.
But I feel like you got on the gig at a really great time for her, which is awesome because she's had a few different renditions of like bands over the last few years. And she's clearly, she's also always innovating her sound every album, every tour. Even now the look is changing from the last tour cycle to this tour cycle. And I feel like in watching her play with you guys, I felt that she was, it seemed like the happiest version of herself and her sound and everything. And was just like, fuck yeah, I got like the band right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think her previous rendition, she kind of, I don't want to totally speak for her, but she's shared too, that like she went so hard on the angular path and like, you know, lots of triggers. I mean, Matt Johnson held that chair for a long time. It was one of my favorites.
That's amazing.
And the level of sophistication in his setup and what has to get triggered when and where and lots of, you know, tracks. And but you know, sometimes tracks gets a bad rap, like, oh, you need tracks to pull off the show. I feel like the way they were using it was like the super high level and like real time, less so playback and more so real time usage of additional elements. Yes. You know?
They were using Ableton like really creative ways.
Like an instrument. Yeah, exactly. Like an instrument, exactly. So, but I think she maybe was just wishing for a different expression, and the fact that like we were on No Click and No Tracks or anything, just that alone.
I didn't know you were on No Click too.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
So I was even surprised. I just blindly assumed that kind of everything, you know, kind of ignorantly, I was like, well, everything at a certain level is going to be on Click, right? Like, oh, SNL. Yeah. I'm sure it's Click. And it wasn't, you know, and Justin, I had a little like visual metronome next to me that would just blink the tempo, and I would just count it off from that. And then once we're in, we're in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I even, with Justin, you know, I was noticing in the early rehearsals, like, oh, it moved a little, or, you know, I look down and it's, you know, it's natural. And I was like, hey, should I, like, if I've, you know, you're an organism moving together, and should I, like, try to keep it if I see it veering off? And he's like, man, whatever. It's going to, if it moves, it moves. You know, if it's 15 BPM slower than when it started, okay, maybe
there's a problem.
Yeah. But in general,
you're probably not going to do that.
Right, right. No, but it felt like a band on stage playing songs.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a rock show. It was awesome.
Really fun. And she's incredible. And I really, just such a joy to be around.
It seemed like she had more freedom in this show. Because I know, compared to the last tour cycle when she was dressed in her like neon latex and it was like very like mechanical, but it was epic. I loved that tour.
And I think her one of her strengths is just intention.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like people are allowed to have preferences, artistic preferences, you know, oh, I prefer this to this, or I like the looser thing over there. But at the, that's later. That's a later discussion. Just the intention of like, I'm going to do this.
Yep.
Is she's a master at that for sure.
So you got the gig. Not from, it wasn't an audition situation. It's a relationship situation. You guys met. He respects your playing, knows who you are clearly, but you developed a friendship and he was like, hey, let's try this. And then it was just straight into rehearsal for SNL.
Yeah. So there was no, again, peak COVID. So there was no other stuff to talk about anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So like maybe in some ways SNL acted as like, oh, we'll see if this works.
Yeah. You know? I mean, it, whether or not that was said, it was obviously it, because if you, if the sound wasn't there, if the vibe wasn't there, you're not going to get called again.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But even if they tell you ahead of time, we will call you. It doesn't,
right.
That doesn't matter anyways.
Yeah. It felt very intuitive.
It was cool, man. I remember watching you guys on SNL and being like, what is this band, dude? Right, this ensemble is sick. I don't even think I knew that you were on it. I think it was just like a see on TV stitch and be like, Mark?
It was pretty DL.
Justin, this is sick. Yeah,
exactly.
Nyana, like it was like so many incredible lineup. So, okay. How on earth, with you doing like a full tour cycle, 18 months, have you been so proficient in releasing music? You put out a full-length album this year. You put out an EP. You put out singles. And now you're about to drop another album? How did you... When did you do this? When do you even do this?
Well, the record that's... well, yeah, let's see. You know, the tour cycle... Technically, yes. Like, SNL was April 2021, and we just last weekend wrapped up. So yeah, that's a year and a half, but plenty of time off, you know, throughout that. And the record Music for Doing was kind of this experimental thing that I did with Pete Min over at his studio, Lucy's Meat Market here in LA. And it wasn't, we didn't even have an intention to make it a record.
Yeah.
It was like, again, everybody's home, kind of locked down. Hey, if you want to come over and make, just work on stuff. Great. So we did that enough times to the point where we had like 6 or 7 quote unquote songs. It's quite experimental, but we had, it's like, maybe this could be a record, you know? So Pete had just started a label and he released that. So that came out earlier this year, but that was again, like just a very casual off the cuff lockdown experiment.
Yeah.
And then February of this year, I went to New York, did a week at the Village Vanguard with my band, my acoustic project, and then we went straight into the studio to record.
Nice.
So that was February, and now we're in October and the record's coming out. So that's the kind of record where we were in the studio for 3 days. I came back home, we did a remote mix for 2 days, and it's done. You know, so I'm excited to get that out and, you know, we're leaving for Europe next week and then, you know, get back to playing some shows.
Wasting no time, making albums on the days off on tour.
There you go.
Tour ends, back to solo touring.
Yeah.
Amazing. And what about Sound of Listening? Was that in the same sessions?
Yeah, so that was the February session.
It has a cohesive sound.
Yeah, so that record, it's kind of like two records in one. Yeah. It's the quartet, half of the record is the songs are set up. We were at the Bunker in Williamsburg. Have you ever been out there?
I have not.
It's beautiful where it has this kind of like modular setup where you can move some walls. You could like, it's all the same room, or you could kind of create walls for a little more isolation. But the intention for this record is, you know, it's just a capturing, you know, what happens when we play together kind of thing. Yeah. So half of the record is that, where you play the song and you say, was that the take, yes or no? And then the other half of the record was slightly more produced. Like the song, The Sound of Listening, is that a little more overdubby and using different woodwinds and synths and stuff. But they kind of, it's kind of on the record, it's like every other track goes from like band, band playing in a studio to a more like slightly more produced thing.
So on Friday, you're playing Zebulon.
Mm-hmm.
Is that with the same group that you did the album with? Same ensemble?
Not the exact personnel. It's the same instrumentation. We're playing that music. The record is Jason Rigby playing saxophone, who is from Cleveland.
Nice.
And is about as big as Joe Lovano fan as it gets.
Amazing.
So props.
My mom's there with them right now.
Oh, really?
They're all in Cleveland.
Oh, yeah, amazing. Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Remind me to tell you my Joe Village Vanguard story. Okay.
Please.
Okay. So, and then Shy Maestro is playing piano on the record, who I played with Avishai Cohen for years and years. And Chris Morrissey is playing bass. Shy and Chris can't do this show, so it's Jason Lindner, who I played with forever.
Yep.
On piano, and Alan Hampton, another like old homie. So it's amazing. I try to keep it in the fam, you know. Of course, I'm open to new relationships with great new musicians, but whenever I can, I try to, you know, keep reaching into the same well, because mm-hmm. I feel like the personal relationships make such a big difference in the trust, and you know,
the energy you've developed with them, and
yeah, it's impossible to fabricate any other way than through time and
the hang.
Yeah. Really quick. So, for me, the Village Vanguard is Mecca. Like when I had the privilege to play there a few times with other people, but they invited me to come with my band. This was 2019, and it was like, okay, I can retire now. I'm good. You know? So we're there and we're all kind of like geeking out. You play from Tuesday to Sunday.
Yep.
Two sets a night. And it's Tuesday afternoon, we're in there setting up, and we're just like, and there's this knock on the door. The door is locked, you know, and we're like, oh, that's weird. So we're just kind of playing some more. It's like this banging, and we're like, what's going on? So, and then someone from the staff opens the door, and it's Mr. Joe Lovano. And he had been playing there the week prior.
Nice.
But he came down, he's like, hey, cats, I just wanted to say, have a great week, you know?
And it's the best, like, dude.
And I was like, this is so surreal. And I think, and for Jason in particular, it was like just playing at the Village Vanguard, you know, the legacy of John Coltrane and the whole thing. And now Lovano's coming down here to like wish us a good, this is, so that was so sweet. He's such a good guy.
Has he seen you play?
Yeah, I think, at festivals here and there. Yeah.
I feel like he would love your playing if he hasn't told you directly.
Yeah, he's truly like, one of the greats. I mean,
he's a great drummer too.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
When he taught at William Patterson before I was there, but I heard that a lot of times for his saxophone lessons, he would just play duo. He would play drums to play with the saxophone students.
So cool.
Yeah.
Not to make them even more nervous.
Right, exactly.
Let me go to my secondary instrument that I'm also killing at. Exactly. And you play my primary instrument in front of me. Thank you. No, but he's such a sweetheart, and he's so loving and inspiring and
amazing.
He's the man, and he's always been like, he's so family focused too. Like I've learned, I'm very lucky to come from just like a loving family. Mm-hmm. Like and Joe's always been, since I was a kid, you just like whoa, he did it
right,
and he did it with jazz. And he's like, because when I was young, he was like, cover a downbeat.
Exactly.
You know, like I was like, what the hell?
Right, right.
I only knew what jazz was because of him.
Because gotcha.
my dad was feeding me like Van Halen, you know.
Totally.
And the Beatles and Zeppelin.
You know, I didn't put it together, or I just didn't know that you guys were related, but I was at the Vic Firth.
The VF Jams
live thing? VF Jams.
Yeah, yeah.
Your brother was there.
Yep.
Who I had, you know, I was just like, eating food in the kitchen or something. And I start chatting, oh, cool, you're Elmo's brother, cool. And then somehow it came up. He's like, oh, you play jazz, do you know? And I was like, oh, of course, that makes sense. So, yeah.
My brother's very easy to talk to. He'll talk to anybody.
Yes, that's great.
Yeah, Joe, my brother's a great, super talented musician as well.
Cool.
Guitar and piano and songwriter. And yeah, Joe's always been super inspiring. And like, to me, it was like that he was the untouchable, right? Mm-hmm. It was just, and also because he was just so cool.
Yep.
And he's just, I mean, it's just vibe, his vibe in general. And it's only recently did he start understanding what Jamcard is, because he's not a tech guy at all. He's not on Instagram or anything, like not even those apps, you know? And so I think he was just like, what is this, an app?
Right.
So it's like a Facebook. I don't like Facebook, you know, kind of, he's a purist, you know? And it was only recently when he was like, oh, and then I think, I don't really know what did it, but recently I was with him at North Sea Jazz Festival this year, which was amazing. His set was incredible. And we had just had an article in Rolling Stone came out on Jamcard.
That was probably right around the time I saw you, right? Or a little after.
Yes. Yeah. I saw you in Copenhagen in beginning of July.
Yep.
I want to say it was the same week or something.
Yeah.
It was like right around then. So I saw him like a week later in at North Sea Jazz Fest. And which was my first time going to that festival. I'm assuming you've
amazing.
Played
and everything. Yeah.
Amazing, dude. Yep. Amazing. But it was cool because Joe like gave me like the biggest congrats ever on just like Jamcard finally. Cause it was always like, you know, like he's the number one person I look up to. He's in my family. I have so much respect for him. And it took a while. I was like in my 20s when he finally, I feel like, respected me as a drummer. Mm-hmm. And I remember that moment was like the best moment of my life.
That's great.
And then similar to, I mean, not so much similar, because I went from drumming and in my projects, I was doing jazz and like metal. I had a group called the Devil's Orchestra that was an instrumental trio, super shred, like Mahavishnu Orchestra on meets Opeth or something.
Right.
Instrumental though. And he came and he was like, power trio. He like loved it because it would like cross genres and it was technical, but it was musical, and he really loved it. And then a couple years later, I started taking pop gigs when I was 25, and he did not approve of me doing pop gigs.
Gotcha.
I'll never forget, like, I went to the Hollywood Bowl to see him play with Wynton Marsalis and the LA Phil, which was incredible. It was him and Wynton up front, and then and the LA Phil, and I went and hung with him backstage after. And like that week, I had played on Ellen with Christina Perry, who's like now one of my best friends, but like, I'll never forget. He said, this is like the worst thing anyone's ever said to me. He was like, hey, Christopher. Cause you know, my real name's Christopher.
I didn't know that.
Elmo's a nickname.
Wow, okay.
There we go. We're live on air, baby.
Great.
So he was like, hey, Christopher, nice job, drumming on, Ellen.
Wow.
And I was like, Joe, come on, man. I'm making a living, man. I'm 25. Right. You know, I'm making money for the first time. Like I was using that money to feed my passion projects. Mm-hmm. And I was obviously what I wanted to get off the ground, but you know how hard that is. And so I was like, fuck. I fucking lost Joe's respect. Fuck.
That's funny.
And then finally, he liked like a lot. He was down with the rock and roll stuff, but not like the singer-songwriter stuff or the pop stuff. He'd probably be down with St. Vincent because it's still artsy.
Right.
He'd be like, okay, cool. But with Christina, he was just like, no, don't.
That's funny.
Don't do that. Like it was, but I respected him even more for having that pure, like the reason why he wasn't happy about this because he wanted me to do my thing.
Exactly.
He's like, do your thing. You know, like. So that was cool. So then, and then when I stopped to start Jamcard, he was like, what? But now he got it. And so it's cool. So anyways, big love to Joe.
Yes.
Speaking of legends, bro, you got to do the last David Bowie album, Black Star. Unbelievable. I have so many questions about that. But I think it ties into like, because I feel like you on St. Vincent was you doing St. Vincent. And I feel like you doing David Bowie was David Bowie working with you where it was still like drum and bassy, or it was like, it felt like your electronica kind of vibe and like, not just like straight, you know, Omar Hakim Bowie rhythms or anything like that. Right. It was very much stylized still for you. So how did you get the gig with Bowie? What was it like working with Bowie? Let's talk for a minute.
So let's see. It all started from his relationship with this woman named Maria Schneider, who's an amazing composer, arranger in New York. And she has this incredible, kind of like a big band, but it's not traditional jazz in any way. But he was a fan of hers. And I think he just approached her like, hey, could we want to work on something together? So they had this one song, and there was something in the song that reminded her of me or something. And she called me and said, hey, I'm working on the song with David Bowie. Would you want to do it? I said, yes. And then, and then we did that one song. So it was me playing with her band. You know, we did a day at Avatar in New York, and he was there and he was great. But we did a couple of rehearsals first. And
what was that like, even there, like the initial meeting and collabing with him?
Oh, it was incredible. So, well, let's see. Okay. She brought him to the 55 bar to hear us, which is wild.
First, so there's like, before you met him.
Yeah.
So he got to see you play first.
Yeah. So
ideal situation. Yeah.
Well, that was the thing. It was like, you're not wrong in that. It was like, because he hired us as a band.
Yeah.
It's Donnie McCaslin playing saxophone, Jason Lindner playing keys, Tim LaFave playing bass, and myself. We had been playing, we made a couple records under Donnie's name.
Yep.
Love those albums.
Everyone listen to those.
Thank you. I had been playing with Jason and Tim in like different versions of beat music for years. So we all had a long relationship. And he hired us as a band, so... Yeah, you're correct in saying that, like, he was the new guy, which is kind of trippy, you know?
Amazing.
But yeah, that first track, because Donnie was in Maria's band. So those first rehearsals, what's that rehearsal space on, like, 27th Street? Euphoria. Mm. I don't know if you know. It's a normal little rehearsal space. And it was, like, David and Tony Visconti, who was producing the track, and then Maria is basically the rhythm section and then like saxophone and trombone just to start. Maria hadn't yet done the full arrangement, so it was to like work out ideas. And he was just so kind, and it was quite normal and all these things. You know, he was there early and left late and was like, hey, can you run that section again? I just want to record it so I could, you know, write to it at home or work on it at home. Just all about the music, you know, and super kind.
Wow.
And yeah, so that day in the studio was great. And then I think it was even Maria's idea. I think he wanted to do more stuff with her, and she said, you should just do a record with those guys. And I was like, okay. So he had reached out to Donnie. Donnie, you know, after they met at that session, he started sending him music, and then we started making the record. You know, that was at the Magic Shop in New York, which is now closed. But we did like 3 one-week sessions.
Mm.
And it was amazing. But yeah, he really encouraged us to like do our thing. And and on several occasions would reference like, hey, I love on that beat music. You know, we made this weird record like 8 years ago, the Los Angeles Improvisations. Jeff Babko, Tim, myself, and Troy Ziegler. And we just improvised, and I
saw you do that at Blue Whale.
Okay, exactly, yeah, yeah. Exactly. So he would reference that record. He'd be like, oh yeah, I really love what you did here. Maybe you could try stuff like that. It's like, oh my God, David Bowie's sitting at home, like listening to this record, you know?
So many incredible things happening.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, it really felt super comfortable and intuitive. And I think, you know, some people were like, you know, many people were asking like, were you nervous? And it's like, maybe there were like flashes of that, but anytime there was a moment of like, holy shit, this is a David Bowie record, I would look out and it's like Tim telling some dumb joke to like, you know, and it's just like, oh, I'm with my homies.
It's your family.
Yeah. And then that's David Bowie over there.
And then the new guy.
Yeah.
He's doing pretty good.
But you know, I'm no expert on his career, but when you look back, like it's pretty consistent with like the Young Americans era. It's like hires this like sick band that's already kind of a community, and he inserts himself into that to writes new songs and gives that thing, and then kind of the Let's Dance thing, and then the yeah. this and the, you know, when he would jump around, it would be, it's not so inconsistent with what we did. And I think the whole point, like Tony Visconti had a funny, kind of a funny line that I read in an interview. He was like, yeah, our idea for this record was, instead of hiring rock guys to play jazz, we hired some jazz guys to play rock. And that's, you know, obviously oversimplified, but also that's kind of cool, you know?
Oh, it's so cool. And that must have felt so validating, because he loves you for your creative self and your music.
It was a huge license that also alleviated any pressure. It's like, exactly. No, just do your thing. It's
exactly.
Like, and he was like egging us on. I remember a couple of times, you know, all the songs had demos with just like program parts. And I would try to be true to the demo, honor his ideas. And we would do a take and be like, okay, cool. But like, go. He even said one time, he was like, Mark, I know what you're capable of. You know, something like that.
Amazing.
So kind of like, literally, you know, egging us on yeah. and being like, no, go.
Do you.
Because that 55 bar gig was like, we were just throwing down, playing too loud and too much. And so it was, that was really fun.
Amazing, dude.
Yeah.
Did you know that he was sick?
We didn't know. Like, his passing was a complete surprise, you know. And it was kind of, but I always say that, you know, like if you listen to the record, he sounds strong as hell. You know, he sounds
incredible.
His performances, all that. So, yeah, it was a unique time for sure. Yeah.
Well, dude, what a blessing that you got to do that collaboration. That's like the collaboration of a lifetime, man.
It truly is, and I can like point so many relationships started from that record. I can very easily draw a line back to that record existing, that like a lot of so many things since have happened, you know, yeah. So I'm forever grateful for sure.
So Matt Cameron's your buddy. You have made friends with the childhood hero.
When was that? 2016. I remember I like, you know, the single came out, Black Star, the video, and I posted it on Facebook. And then, you know, you get some nice comments and all this stuff. And then there was a comment from Matt Cameron. And I'm like, well, clearly there's got to be more than one Matt Cameron in the world. And I clicked on the profile. I was like, wait, is that him? And I sent him a message. And I was like, Matt Cameron? Like, really? And then we started going back and forth. And Pearl Jam was coming to MSG a couple months later and met him then. And then he started sending me music. I ended up playing drums on his solo record.
Oh, no way.
Called Cave Dweller. Yeah. So that was completely wild. It's one thing to meet a hero, but then now I'm like tracking on his album. He's playing guitar and singing. He's a great songwriter. So now I'm like doing takes in the studio, and I finish a song and I look into the control room. He's giving thumbs up. I'm like, why are you not
on drums?
Yeah. So he's such a sweet guy, and that friendship has been super meaningful. And then, so yeah, that's one of those examples of, you know, maybe we would have run into each other in as touring musicians, and I could meet him and say hi, but because of that record, you know, it started a friendship. And and then just the other day, the last show with St. Vincent was at the Ohana Festival in Dana Point, and that's Eddie Vedder's festival. Mm. And he was hanging out after, you know, he came back to just hang with us after our set. And
Matt or Eddie?
Eddie. Yeah, who I've met a handful of times, because Matt actually... try to make it brief, but yeah, Pearl Jam for me, I had the 10 poster on my wall as
we
kid.
All did,
you know, I mean, yeah, just yeah. crazy. So,
so Eddie comes backstage,
but the previous times, like there were a few like, very surreal moments where Matt invited me. They were playing at Fenway like 4 years ago. And there's one song where Eddie plays cowbell, that they don't play it too often, but there's like cowbell in the track, and Eddie would just play it quarter notes, you know, while he sings. But he's like, dude, if you come to the show, you should play cowbell. So I sat in at Fenway playing quarter notes on a cowbell.
Come on.
Yeah, and it was like...
With Pearl Jam.
Exactly.
Come on, dude.
To that point, it was hands down the most people I had ever played in front of, and it's like just quarter notes on a cowbell, you know? That's why I went to music school. But then, you know, I've bumped into those guys over the years, and actually, in May of this year, Pearl Jam was at the Forum, and Matt invited me to come down. He wanted to play a song paying tribute to Taylor Hawkins.
Yeah.
So there's this tune that Taylor wrote that the Foo Fighters would play. So Matt went out front to play guitar and sing, and he had me play drums. And so that was cool, very surreal.
Oh, yeah. Christian, you were there for that, right?
Oh, sick.
He told me, he was like, Mark's on drums with Pearl Jam right now. I'm like, what is Mark doing? He's everywhere.
And then, yeah, and just to make the childhood hero thing even more surreal, I look over unannounced. I'm like halfway through the song. I look over and Chad Smith's playing tambourine. I'm like, this is just wild.
Was you on cowbell at Fenway.
Exactly.
Chad Smith.
So it's been, I've had the honor to hang out with those guys. But just this last weekend, Eddie was hanging out after the show. And again, it's like we're just hanging out. Everything's cool. We're talking about Mad. But then, you know, he's like, he brought up Bowie because of Black Star, that being, you know, the beginning of particular relationships. And he's like, oh yeah, I never got to meet David, but we chatted on the phone a couple times. We both really loved plays, and we were just talking about different plays that we had been checking. It's just so beautiful. But for like, you know, it's still kind of like a pinch me moment for like someone to even be associated with Bowie, and never mind Eddie Vedder thinking of me as the guy who played with him and drawing that connection. It's very surreal. That's amazing. To say the least. Yeah.
I mean, that album's incredible too. It's not just like, it's obviously his landmark, like final album, and with lyrical messages that were like obviously intentionally put in there for us to understand at a later moment. It was so deep, and but it's musically beautiful too. And it's a very significant, important album.
And it's really two quick little anecdotes. The second to last gig we played was in Vegas. So this last Saturday, there's like a theater in the Palms, and we play. And then me and Jason Faulkner, the guitar player, incredible musician, we were playing roulette after the show. Just $100. Let's see what happens. And there was this really kind of, you know, charismatic, kind of tough East Coast like roulette dealer. But he's like, hey, what's your name? Okay, what are you doing here? Oh, we played. Oh, you play music. Okay. And then he's like, who are you? He said to Jason, who are your favorites? You know, and Jason was like, oh, I don't know, you know, Bowie, you know, just like this list of it. He's like, Bowie? Yeah, man, wasn't it crazy that last album? Like the lyrics and stuff, it's almost like he scripted the whole thing. And we were just like nodding, and it's a very surreal.
You didn't say anything?
No, what am I gonna?
What do you mean, no?
No, you just let it go. But even that,
he'd like, be like, put it on red, 33. Yeah.
No, but that for that to, you know, that guy having no knowledge of the connection, but it's like for that to have permeated so far, you know, into so many people's minds. But I will say, usually when someone says, what do you do? Oh, I play music. Oh, what kind of music? I just try to get myself out of these conversations at all costs, right? It's like, no. If it's small talk, you're checking in at the airport.
For sure. Yes.
So I'm just like, oh, what kind of music? It's like, I don't know. It's just, you know. I don't know.
Avant-garde jazz, you'd hate it. Yeah.
And then there was this one time where this guy picked me up in an Uber. I had my cymbal bag. The guy's maybe 25, and I was living in Jersey City, and it was like 2 weeks after the first Bowie single came out. Oh, what's that? What's in there? You know, cymbals. Oh, you play drums? Yeah. Oh, who do you play with? I'm like, no, really. Cool. And he was really pressing me. Anybody I would know? And I'm like, if there's ever a time, but I feel, I'm like, David Bowie? And he goes, oh, I don't know.
Oh, man.
So that's the lesson. I was like, see, that's why I never, I'm like, it was like crushing me to even do it. I'm like, am I really going to drop this name? And then the kid didn't know him. And I was like, that's why.
He's like, oh, I'll check him. Is he on Spotify? Yeah.
It was actually, perfect. It was perfect. So anyway, and I bet Bowie would have loved that story.
Oh,
so,
for yeah. sure, man. Dude, so, I mean, yeah, you got Bowie on the res, you have St. Vincent, and then obviously your music. I mean, you got Grammy nominated for Beat Music. Incredible. That must have also felt very validating.
That was a total surprise, yeah.
Man, I feel like every year, maybe once a year, I go, Mark! Like, about like some one of your accomplishments.
That's funny. Yeah, that came
out. You had my vote that year. It was a great album.
Thank you. Yeah, that really came out of the blue, and it kind of validated the, don't try to don't make art for that validation. It's like, in a perfect world, you know, maybe some people hear it and it gets some positive attention, but yeah. Like it kind of renewed some faith of like, oh yeah, just like keep your head down, keep going. If stuff happens, cool. But either way, I just saw this Prince, I'm sure we've all heard it, but they're like, popped up on Instagram, this Prince quote from years and years ago of like, the artist, the success of a release is upon its creation. Like artistically, the artist is like, oh, that's the success. It's, I made it. Like it's made.
Yeah.
And then once it gets released and gets reviewed, then all of that starts to change. And because you're seeing or experiencing the art through all these different perspectives. But if you can hold on to like, I'm just going to make a thing and set it free and go work on the next thing, you know, that's kind of how I try to operate. But,
seems very healthy to do that.
It's yeah. On a good day I can do it. And on another day I'm just staring at the phone and questioning my existence, you know,
but, like, yeah. Should I start making videos with a new angle?
Exactly. Should I? That's the answer.
Prince said, he was like, if it's not working for you, try a different angle.
Try a different angle.
On your cell phone.
Yeah. Exactly.
Dude, that is so cool. Well, I would love to touch, and we'll wrap up soon, but on family, a couple things. So you have a son, you have mm-hmm. a wife, amazing. You have a wife that's in the arts, also an incredible singer, artist, notable on her own. How do you balance being Mark while being dad, while being husband, and while having a wife doing her artistic career as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Gretchen Parlato is my wife, and I think the advantage we have is that we were both ourselves before we even got together. So it's not like I've seen some, and this is not impossible to do, but I've seen some friends who, maybe things start to take off inside of a relationship and then it's this big shift and then you have to reorganize
how things went. Insecurities and whatever.
Yeah,
whatever,
or just the true practicality of being gone or this and that. So I think the timing, I mean, with a relationship, you know, it's so difficult to script. Well, you can't script how it's going to work. So I feel so lucky that we kind of both had our time to dig into our stuff. And then it was like, you know, we had our foundation and really we're fans of each other. So it's like, we're constantly encouraging each other to do what feels right artistically. Beautiful. And then for our son, Marley, it's like similarly, it's just what he knows. So it's never easy. I think it's harder for me to leave than it is for him. Cause it's like, oh yeah, my dad's going to go for a couple weeks. And then, just even in this last month, you know, with St. Vincent, we were on this Roxy Music tour, opening for Roxy Music, and we were at Madison Square Garden. I was like, I can't be at Madison Square Garden without you guys there. You know, okay, miss a couple days of school. I think it's fine. It's third grade.
Life
you know,
experience.
So, yeah, so yeah. Flew them out, and we had a couple days in New York, and to have them in the house is huge.
So you know? Cool.
So we try to do that as often as we can. We were all together in Europe for about a week. And yeah, he just kind of rolls with the punches. Like, again, at they were at Ohana and we're just hanging, and Marley was drawing some pictures and Eddie's hanging out. He's like, hey, I want to, can I teach him how to draw a wave? And then now, like, Eddie and Marley are off in the corner just drawing pictures together. It's like, this is like, wait.
What a cool
this
kid.
This is so surreal. Yeah. But he's like, who's this guy? You know?
That's so funny.
So yeah, it was very, it's, we just try to make it as normal as possible.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it feels a little like, whoa, this is a lot, but he rolls with it. I think he's the most flexible out of the three of us, you know?
He seems super cool.
Yeah, super mellow. And yeah, it's great. And I think we just, the nice thing about, for both of us, when we're gone, we're gone. And that hurts. But when we're home, we're kind of just home.
Yeah.
And we're chilling, you know. So we really make the most of that time and just hang. Yeah.
So you got, yeah, you got the Europe tour coming up. And then you can just go back to that.
Yes.
Go into the family for the holidays.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing, dude.
Yeah, it'll be a nice way to wind down for the year, for sure.
Well, dude, you've had a big year. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm, let me just say, welcome to the neighborhood, even though you've been here for like 2 years.
You.
I'm so happy to have you here.
Yeah.
When I discovered how close you were, I was like, dude, this is great.
Totally.
This is, it really feels like, I feel like this area, a lot of it feels like the new kind of Brooklyn, like New York, especially the Los Feliz, Atwater, Silver Lake, Echo Park, Highland Park.
Yep.
And there's more and more people constantly moving out here from New York. And I feel like you were a big part of that, actually. Because it started, obviously, before you, the New York exodus. Even started before COVID.
Yeah, for sure.
Where it was like, oh, so-and-so's here, so-and-so's here. Wow, I never thought they would. And then when you moved here, I was like, Mark is here too? Wow, that I was not expecting that.
Right.
And then I think a lot of other people are like, okay, well, Mark's gone.
Well, no.
That's
funny. That's funny.
I'll just fly back when he's at the Vanguard.
That's funny. That's funny. No, it feels great to have so many friends, you know? Yeah. It doesn't... Because I... just from coming out, this would be a frequent tour stop anyway. So I'd end up out here a couple times a year, and then you're like making LA friends, but then so many East Coast friends. It's great.
Yeah. Do you feel that LA is better for collaborating today?
I don't know. I feel like it's hard to say. I feel like I used to think like 20 years ago, when like people would be like, do you have to move to New York to pursue like, say, creative music and prevent? Yes. Like a hard line. Yes. You have to be there. And I think more and more that's loosening up. Like my advice to younger people is like, cause it's so expensive and all this stuff. It's like, if you could get there, I know this is also expensive, but if you could do a weekend every couple months and crash on a buddy's couch and, you know, I feel like even that is more realistic now, and you get a taste of the city without having to be there or without having to live there. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, what makes a place great is the people, right? So if you can, with all these friends out here, I think that might be the case. But
you can also use the internet as a tool.
Well, exactly.
Before you show up to the city, do your best to make the best digital presence you can.
Exactly.
So when people check you out, they're like, oh yeah, this guy's sick. Right. Oh, he's in LA. Oh yeah, I'll meet you.
Oh, that's the guy with that angle. He's got that.
He's got the right angle. Yeah, he found it.
Yeah.
It's like on his ceiling though, right? But it works for him.
That's funny.
Well, dude, thank you for coming and spending time talking with us, man.
Anytime.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Anytime. Tomorrow before he leaves?
Yep.
Getting back. Well, I'll see you tomorrow at your show. Oh, Friday.
Oh, yeah, Friday.
I'll see you Friday at the show. Really excited for that.
Thank you, man.
Go and, with Elmo. Just keep killing the game, Mark.
Go with Elmo. 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 This is the stuff, man.